Good morning. I call this meeting to order.
Thank you. This is the December 8th, 2025 Citizens General Obligation Bond Oversight Committee meeting. The time is 9:30 and we will begin with roll call.
Roll call, please.
Vice Chair Crawford, absent. Member Fox.
Present.
Member Larkin.
Present.
Member Cui McNulty.
Present.
Member Pantoja.
Present.
Member Tingle.
Present.
Chair Tung.
Present.
Thank you. A quorum is present.
Okay. So before calling the first item, we acknowledge that we are on the unceded ancestral homeland of the Ramaytush Ohlone, who are the original inhabitants of the San Francisco Peninsula. As the indigenous stewards of this land and in accordance with their traditions, the Ramaytush Ohlone have never ceded, lost, nor forgotten their responsibilities as the caretakers of this place, as well as for all peoples who reside in their traditional territory. As guests, we recognize that we benefit from living and working on their traditional homeland. We wish to pay our respects by acknowledging the ancestors, elders, and relatives of the Ramaytush community and by affirming their sovereign rights as First Peoples. And next, for our new member welcome and introduction, I would like to welcome the newest member of our committee, Ben Tingle. Commissioner Tingle, would you like to introduce yourself to the commissioners and the public?
Sure, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm happy to be here and join you all, learn from you and participate. Just as a very quick intro so we can get started, I live kind of between the DuBose Triangle and Castro neighborhoods. The first sort of half adult life, I was in DC and worked in the federal government, kind of in the intersection of foreign policy and trade. And then the second half, I've worked on in management consulting and a lot of organizational capacity issues and effectiveness. And so I've been looking for ways to get involved locally and helped the Lurie transition in January on interviews and kind of setting up the office. And I've been looking at different ways to get involved in the city. And this one seemed pretty exciting. And as far as understanding how we can push for more effectiveness in spending and administration in the city. So happy to join you all and be here. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for your willingness to serve. Next, can we take general public comment?
Thank you. Item number two, general public comment, opportunity for the public to comment on any matters within the committee's jurisdiction that are not on the agenda. Members of the public who wish to provide in-person public comment, please line up at the podium now. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak. For the record, there are no in-person public comments. This concludes a public comment section for this agenda item.
Thank you. Please call the next item.
Item number three, approval with possible modification of the meeting minutes from October 27, 2025.
Commissioners, are there any corrections or comments to the minutes?
No, none for me.
Seeing none, please take public comment.
Members of the public who wish to provide in-person public comment, please line up at the podium now. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak. For the record, there are no in-person public comments. This concludes the public comment section for this agenda item.
Commissioners, could I ask for a motion and a second to approve the minutes?
So moved. Second.
Thank you.
We have a motion from Member Larkin and a second from Member Pantoja. Do our roll call vote. Vice Chair Crawford, absent. Member Fox?
Aye.
Member Larkin?
Aye.
Member Cui McNulty?
Aye.
Member Pantoja?
Aye.
Member Tingle?
Aye.
Chair Tung?
Aye.
Thank you. The motion passes.
Please call the next item.
Item number four, presentation on the 2016 Public Health and Safety GO Bond Programs.
Get started. Yeah.
Good morning, Chair Tung, Vice Chair Crawford, and members of the City Global Committee. My name is Joe Chin, Public Works Program Manager for the 2016 Public Health and Safety Bond Program. I'm here this morning to provide City Global with an annual update of the projects tracked under the 2016 PHS program. Before I start with the formal presentation, I would like to acknowledge and also thank members of the Public Works Project Management Team and also client department representatives that are present this morning in support of the PHS program. In the room, I see representatives from fire, so thank you for sending aside time to attend this meeting. It means a lot to Public Works and everyone else here. My last presentation to City Global was earlier this year in February. This first slide is a quick reminder of the total bond authorization amount and the allocation to each of the six bond components under the 2016 PHS program. This bond program was approved for a total bond authorization amount of $350 million. The total bond authorization amount currently is showing $364 million because it includes approximately $14 million of bond interest earnings that have been appropriated as of last fiscal year. $279 million has been allocated to three DPH components, which includes the ZSFG Building 5, Southeast Health Center, and the Community Health Centers. $45.1 million has been allocated to two San Francisco Fire Department components, which includes the Ambulance Deployment Facility and the Neighborhood Fire Stations. $20.1 million has been allocated to the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. This next slide is an executive summary that highlights the program accomplishments this past year, upcoming milestones, status of bond sales and appropriation, and any risks, issues, or concerns on budget, scope, or schedule. We're approaching the 10th year after approval of the PHS program. As of 2023, three of the six components have been completed and are currently in the closeout phase. This includes the Community Health Center, Southeast Health Center, and the Ambulance Deployment Facility. On the ZSFG Building 5 component, we still have six projects that are in active construction. Both the Clin Lab and the Rehabilitation Department Phase 3 reached substantial completion earlier this year. The ZSFG Building 5 component remains the most active component among the PHS program. On the Neighborhood Fire Station component, the emergency generator project at Fire Station 3744 was completed in September of 2025. On the homeless service site component, 1001 Polk Street also reached substantial completion in October of 2025, with 525 Fifth Street scheduled to be completed by the end of next year. The key takeaway and good news is that we are working toward wrapping up all the majority of the active construction projects by the end of 2026 under this program, as well as ideally start the financial closeout process for this bond program by next year. Regarding bond sales and appropriation for the program, the main update is that we have completed the arbitrage payment in the amount of $1.4 million, which leaves around $1.42 million in reserves that can be allocated for use by projects. There have been no significant changes to the risks and challenges that we have been tracking since the onset of the program. Furthermore, most of these risks and challenges do not directly apply on the current projects, except for possibly Fire Station 15, because permitting, design, and bidding activities have been completed. The current budget for the ZSFG component is $218 million. Expenditures and encumbrances combined is approximately $211.6 million, with approximately a remaining balance of $3.2 million. Both the Clin Lab and Rehab project reached substantial completion this past year and are currently in the final stages of DPH operational transition. Dallas relocation is 97% complete with a focus on obtaining HCAR approval for staffing of stock, which would then allow ZSFG clinical staff to start training and operational licensing of the new clinic through the California Department of Public Health. You may recall in past presentations where I have emphasized that one of the main challenges working Building 5 are the existing post-tension tendons within the building structural slab that must be protected from damage throughout all construction activities. Unfortunately, despite all efforts to document the existing PT tendons through GPR scanning, Multiple tendons were damaged when the ceiling contractor was drilling and installing anchors to the ceiling. We have submitted the repair procedure to HCOG for approval and is going through the plan review process as we speak. Contractor is responsible for the costs and the delays associated with the PT tendon repair. But the repair itself will delay the project completion until early 2026. Seismic upgrade is at 85% complete, which is a major accomplishment because we have less than 20 individual locations remaining to finish. For the past few years, we have been working on the building, on building the new columns and beams to support the new 25-inch wide seismic joint as we work up the building. We are now working down the building to create the new new seismic joint. Unfortunately, this is also the most disruptive phase of the construction activities as the contractor is chipping out significant amounts of concrete while the building remains occupied and operational. ZSSG staff has been doing a great job in communicating these impacts to hospital leadership and staff, and we have been able to proceed with the work with minimal disruptions and only slight adjustments to the contractor's work schedule. And then one last thing on the public health lab is also 82% complete with a focus on completing the architectural finishes, furniture installation, and also starting of the HVAC and laboratory equipment commissioning next year. IT infrastructure is 75% complete with the completion of the new chiller equipment activation and commissioning. The remaining activities include the installation of the chill water piping to serve the IDF rooms and spaces. Psychiatric emergency services is 40% complete with activities focused on metal slab framing and overhead MEP installation. Family Health Center Phase 1 is also 40% complete. Because of funding constraints, this project was separated into multiple phases with Phase 1 focused on demolition and abatement only. Public Works continue to work with ZSFG staff to confirm additional funding that will allow the Phase 2 to proceed, which will now include the build out of the select areas. Southeast Health Center has been open to patients since July 29, 2022. All post-construction change order work has now been completed, and we are now targeting to issue final completion by first quarter of 2026. The Community Health Center component tracks two comprehensive Community Health Center projects that include seismic retrofit and interior renovation scopes. They are the Maxine Hall Health Center located in District 5 and Castro Mission located in District 8. The good news is that Public Works issued final completion as well as final payment for the Castro Mission Health Center project earlier this year, and we are now proceeding with a financial closeout of the project. The ambulance deployment facility project has also been in use since May 10th, 2021, with the final completion issued back in February 2023. The neighborhood fire station component consists of the hose tower removal at six fire stations, at fire station 6, 11, 12, 15, and 21, and 38, to mitigate the seismic risks, and emergency generator replacements at three fire stations, at fire station 18, 37, and 44. The emergency generator replacement project at fire station 37, 44 was completed in September of 2025. The other emergency generator project at fire station 18 will commence with field activities by January 2026 and then followed by the installation of the emergency generator later that year. The bidding for the final host tower project at fire station 15 has now been deferred for the time being while the team works with the San Francisco Planning Department, hopefully come up with a strategy that will avoid the reconstruction of the host tower, which is the primary cost driver for the project. On the homeless service site component, there's one remaining active construction project. 1001 Polk Street consists of HVAC upgrades and limited structural repairs. This project achieved substantial completion in October of 2025. 525 Fifth Street consists of renovation and upgrades of all restrooms and showers, kitchen replacement, and new storage in the day room. This project is currently 65% complete with a target completion by third quarter of 2026. This final slide is a detailed summary that shows the original and revised program budget and expenditures and encumbrances for all bond components. I do want to point out that for the overall PHS program, there is remaining balance of approximately $8.5 million. This represents approximately 2% of the $364 million revised budget. In the latest CGOBOX status report, we have added some additional slides and additional tables and narrative that summarizes the non-PHS funding that have been provided by the client department to supplement the funding for the PHS projects. Moving forward, the non-PHS funding sources will be the primary fund source to complete these projects. This completes my formal presentation for today. My team and I are now available to take any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you for your thoughtful report. Commissioners, any questions or comments on the presentation?
I had a couple.
Please go ahead.
Right, Joe, first one is the promised softball question. I didn't know what HCAI was.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thank you, Member Larkin. Sorry, HCAI, so HCAI, I think a few years ago, had rebranded. So they used to be known as OSHPA, which is probably a more familiar name that you're used to, Office of Health Care Planning and Development. They've now become a department. So their HCAI stands for Department of Health Care Access and Information. So they grew from an office to a department now.
They're to be congratulated. I had a question particularly about the Building 5 at Zuckerberg, SF General. The cost of project controls was like identical to the cost of construction, like $106 million, 156, can't read my writing. I've asked this before and you've told me what is included in the scope of project controls, but could you go over that again?
Sure. So under project controls, we generally use that line item to track all costs other than construction. So that includes the cost of designers, meaning architects, engineers, also includes any kind of consultants that are needed to support the project. So in this case, because it's an OSHPOD or hospital project, we also need to carry the cost of hiring a inspector that's certified by the state, so an OSHPA inspector. And because we are working in an existing building, we do have all a cost associated with an environmental consultant that provides oversight to all the demolition and abatement work that's going on, as well as kind of our construction management team that serves as liaison between the project and the contractor and everything else.
Well, it was, like I said, about 50% for Building 5 and the other projects, it was substantially less. Was there something special about Building 5?
Good question. I think I've said this before, but Building 5 is just one of the toughest building environment to work in. Okay. Just because it is an operational facility. It's an old building. We have, as mentioned earlier, post-tension tendons that seems in the way of every work we try to do. We always encounter it. We always have to go back and do fine adjustments to the design because we don't know until we finish demolition to know what's out in the slab. So when we do the layout between the final design and what's in the field, we then identify conflicts. We've kind of learn from different projects, we've actually tried to do something smarter now where we actually separate the demolition from construction. So we have a lot of these projects that we actually focus on doing early demolition that allows to clear the slate so we have a kind of a clear slab. Then we then have a contractor do the initial scanning, layout of the walls, but then we take that information back to the design team. So hopefully they can then massage the design and kind of do an as-built of what's out there, and then modify the design before we got to bid for the larger renovation project. So I think so far we've done it on two projects. It's been helping with the schedule delays and the impacts.
Well, you had me when you told me that it was an older building. For whatever reason, I thought it was the newer one that
Building 25, the new hospital. No.
So that would explain a lot of it. You said that the contractor was responsible for the damage to the post-tensioning cables. He it has to repair them, but it's delaying the project. That's a non-compensable delay, I'm guessing?
Correct. That is not, it is actually the reverse. If we are actually, we have notified the contractor we intend to assess liquidated damages.
You're going to assess LD.
Because these are contractor cost delay as opposed to, you know, traditionally what we're used to seeing, either non-compensable or city cost delay or owner cost delay. Therefore, those are not compensable. Actually, the city ends up paying contractor for their extended overhead. Yeah. In this case, it's a reverse situation where it's a contractor cost delay. We've also notified a contractor that, hey, this is your issue that you created. You've delayed the project. Under the contract, we do have liquidated damages provision, so we have notified them that we intend to assess the LDs for those delays.
Good luck. That was the one question. Oh yeah. On the community health center, you said that the final completion was this year, but it had been open for service, I think, since 2022?
Correct. Member Larkin, you're probably referring to Castro Mission Health Center. So as soon as the project was completed, there were some client requested change orders that we had to proceed with, some of which were related to leakage in the building. So we had to go back, hire a architect to come up with new details to caulk some of the existing windows and some of the walls that were leaking. So that also delayed the completion of the project, which led to the...
But there was substantial, there was what, beneficial occupancy of the property. So
That's correct. So the work was ongoing while the clinic was occupied. We just need to work with the clinic's operational hours so that we didn't impact the patient care while we were doing the work on the outside.
Cost 22. All right. Thanks, Joe. That's all I had.
Thank you.
I had a question.
Yes.
Fire Station 15, the Seismic Hose Tower. Not being familiar with that project, could you just speak a little bit about having to take a step back and reevaluate the scope? What changed in the project that will cause that delay as far as execution?
Sure. Michael, do you want to take this one? Or
I can pivot. I think you know it better. I'll defer to my colleague, Michael Rossetto.
Good morning. My name is Michael Rossetto. I am no longer the project manager of Station 15, but I was for a while, so I'm very familiar with it. Station 15 is one of the hose tower. Most of the fire stations that had hose towers with seismic issues, the hose towers were removed and not replaced. This is the one station that the planning department has required that a replacement tower be built for historic reference purposes. Recently, the cost estimate for the project has increased significantly, and there's many people who question the necessity to rebuild this hose tower as a gesture to the historic reference. So we're trying to step back and have discussions with the planning department to see if there's any possibility of them lifting the requirement to rebuild the tower, which will reduce the cost of the project. It's still quite an expensive project to undertake, removal of this tower. There's a lot of logistical challenges. It's directly adjacent to a narrow drive aisle and then a wall that separates it from a major muni station. So it's a very complicated project from the construction, especially the demolition portion, bringing down the tower and then to rebuild it. So we're trying to see what we can do to simplify the project.
Thank you for clarifying. To be clear, historical preservation is the reason for keeping it?
Yes.
For rebuilding?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Even though obviously it's replacing it it's not retrofitting the existing tower in place, it's just rebuilding it. So we're questioning that need.
I have a follow-up question to that. So the retrofitted historic hose tower, will that be a functioning hose tower? Is it just?
The only function that the tower, there's two functions right now that I'm aware of. It provides access to the roof of the station. which needs to be maintained. The firefighters do use the roof for weekly training. We aren't planning on removing that access. The tower itself, from say roof access, it's about 25 or 30 feet additional height to the top of the existing tower. There are antennas mounted at the top. So we will work with the Department of Technology to find a suitable location to keep those antennas in function. We just don't feel it needs to be an additional $500,000 of a tower to do that. So that's our argument, our case with the planning department. Okay. Yes.
Just curious, is there a timeline been set for these conversations or negotiations to yield to some compromise solution?
Personally, since I'm not involved in those in these conversations, I'm not personally aware of any timelines being set. I know they've been recently, as roughly September, October, that the project manager, with input from the fire department, decided to not proceed with bidding the project because of the high cost estimate. And then that led to some conversations with the planning department, but I'm not aware of any deadlines being set to try to resolve this.
It just would be advisable in any of these situations not to have this kind of ongoing discussions without having some, you know, preconceived timeline. Thank you.
I had one question. I was just curious, general sort of context. So for this, the potential rebuild of the tower, based on planning department input, what is the process of that sort of going through with, you know, does the fire department sort of say with the project manager that they need this, they don't need this, and then the planning, I was just curious sort of that process with the planning department, at which point it sort of was told, I guess, as a requirement to rebuild.
So my understanding, going back several years, when there was these five or six
host towers.
Host tower project, there are six stations?
At least six.
So my understanding is, at the time, the planning department, they made a concession to allow the host towers to be removed, but they wanted one fire station to be the historical reference to when hose towers were functioning, to dry hoses. Hose materials have changed, and they no longer need to be hung to dry. That's the issue. So,
Magdalena Raya, Bureau Manager, and I talked with Tony Biaggi, who cannot be here today, about this station all the time because it's. And I wanted to point out, Michael, you missed the cost. It's $1.5 million to rebuild this fire hose station. And from the perspective of our client, fire department, they would like to avoid this cost and use that $100.5 million somewhere else for, let's say, roof repair or replacement or other needs that they have at other stations. Just wanted to add that comment.
Any other questions?
I don't have a question about, or a question, period, about the host towers or fire stations, but I just wanted to say thank you very much, Joe, and all of you for that really great presentation, and to encourage all members of the CEGOBOC to tour, especially Zuckerberg Building 5. Some of the completed projects there, I just had the opportunity to tour last month, I think. And it is just so, this, as Joe mentioned, this project has been going on for so long, and it's really rewarding as a member of the CEGOBOC to see many of these projects, you know, in their final stages. So it's really a great education if you have an opportunity to tour that building.
Are you planning a field visit?
I just had one a few weeks ago. Yeah. So, but I think, Joe, you're open to providing tours for other Siegelbach members. Yeah. And also, thank you so much for including the reporting on the non-PHS funding. Excuse me, in your report, I really like to see that just how bond funding can help, encourage other funders to come to the table, whether they be philanthropic or maybe other state or local grants. I think it's really, really nice to see that bond funding can, continue or help get additional funding.
Right. I think that we probably will want tours across a number of the different programs since we have added new members in the last year. So we'll try and reach out and coordinate something with all the program managers on that. Also, once we get more clarification on how many committee members are allowed to participate in any given tour at a single time, so that would be useful. I also, as a public finance person, I was glad to see that we had calculated our arbitrage rebate liability and made that payment. Some people might say, well, we're making a rebate payment to the federal government. Isn't that a bad thing? But in my experience, as when I was a staffer, it was a good thing because it meant that you were generating as much interest as possible to fund additional construction projects. So even though that's money that's not available to pay for projects, it means that we have kind of maximized that as a new source. So it's good to see that we're tracking that and it's not inadvertently getting allocated to projects and then we're having to go back and find another source to pay that liability. So thank you for that. If there are no further comments or questions, then can we please take public comment?
Members of the public who wish to provide in-person public comment, please line up at the podium now. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak. For the record, there are no in-person public comments. This concludes the public comment section for this agenda item.
Please call the next item.
Item number 5. Fiscal year 2024 and fiscal year 2025 liaison reports on the 2012 Clean and Safe Neighborhood Parks GO bond programs.
Good morning, everybody. This is Bart. So the 2024 report, to pretty much sum it up, obviously 2008 was a while back. 2012 has been slowly but surely coming to an end. So the 2008 bond, this is as of 2024, of $185 million was sold in 4 increments and expended in alignment with the intended use of the money, and they have completed 75 projects. And then 97% of the 2012 bond issuance are spent and encumbered, with 77 projects having been completed. Park and Rec has continued to do a really good job of maximizing these bond funds by leveraging gifts, grants, and development fees to build a wonderful public recreation space for our city residents. In 2025, all that to say that the 2012 bond has now completed 80 projects. And so they're about 99% of the issuances are spent or encumbered. I would like to say, though, that in spite of unfortunate stalls in federal funding, the Recreation and Parks Department and the Port of San Francisco have maximized these bond funds by leveraging gifts, grants, and development fees. The bond revenue is being used effectively for the benefit of our city residents. This year has been a tough year. The byproduct of the volatility of tariffs and other market drivers have stifled the philanthropic entities from donating as they have in the past. I think their worry has come to them for tightening the purse strings. So unfortunately, some of these things have trickled down to our parks. But aside from that, again, the Park and Recreation Department continues to do a great job of leveraging money wherever they can. And what's great about parks is that you don't have to organize a tour. You can just go to the park, walk around. And actually, so McLaren Park is the last project on 2012. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it should be done early next year, the trails. So these things hopefully will be able to put a pin in them, and they'll be done. And we'll be hearing reports next year from Park and Recreation that 2012 is done. So those are my reports.
Okay.
Thank you. Any comments or questions from our commissioners? Hearing none, can we take public comment, please?
Members of the public who wish to provide in-person public comment, please line up at the podium now. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak. For the record, there are no in-person public comments. This concludes the public comment section for this agenda item.
Okay. Please call the next item.
Item number 6, updates from Controller's Office staff.
Good morning, committee members. Chair Tung, Vice Chair Crawford, Mark De La Rosa, Director of Audits for the Controller's Office. I'll be speaking to items 6A and 6B today, and I'll be joined by Natasha Mihal from the City Performance Division to discuss the second item. But for the first one, since we last reported back in October, there have been no new updates in terms of issuances and completed work products related to our public integrity reviews. We continue to work with our city attorney's office colleagues, as well as our auditors in the CSA Audits Division, to complete a number of public integrity audits and assessments, including those for nonprofits, including Collective Impact, Parks Alliance, and the Treasurer Tax Collector procurement. For item 6B, just very quickly, on the CSA audit side, we have issued a handful of audits and assessments in the last couple of months, just highlighting a couple of the performance audits that we completed. One is an audit of the Department of Public Health secondary employment process. This was an audit that we issued last month in November. The audit found that to further support ongoing compliance, the department must strengthen coordination of all additional employment requests, create a mechanism to seek feedback, and provide guidance to managers. The second audit that I'd like to highlight is our audit of procurement at the airport, where we looked at the facilities division. We found that they did not consistently follow policies and procedures related to procurement, and that they also lack formal training policy for the procurement process. We are completing our field work for one of our GO bond expenditure audit, which is for the 2020 Health and Recovery GO bond, which we plan to issue in February 2026. And we will be initiating a couple more audits that are GO bond related. One is for the 2020 ESER and 2018 seawall earthquake safety. Both will be initiated in the next few weeks and will be issued in Q4 of this fiscal year. In addition, we continue our work on the various audit programs that we have in CSA audits, including whistleblower, and our compliance and performance audit of various internal controls throughout the city, including construction, following up on recommendations that we've let over the last few years, as well as our nonprofit compliance and internal controls audit programs. That is all that I have for CSA audits. I will turn it over to Natasha. First, any questions related to anything that I've discussed?
Good morning, committee members. Natasha Mihal, City Performance Director. Just a few updates on our side. This is the season of our annual report. So last week, we issued our nonprofit annual report. So this is our nonprofit monitoring program where we coordinate city departments. So we have two components. One is our longstanding fiscal compliance monitoring program, where we work with departments to cover about 85% of the spending of nonprofits are involved in that program. We try to streamline the fiscal monitoring of an individual nonprofit, not at the contract level, but at the nonprofit level, so we coordinate between departments. Through that work, we are finding what the issues are, some of the concerns when nonprofits are not passing all of their standards are related to some issues on completing a financial audited statement, some cash flow issues, which is a little bit newer this year that we're finding. Also through that program, we do designate certain nonprofits into corrective action tiers. So that is to make sure that they can meet all of the standards that are required. So this year we have 14 nonprofits on tier two and 2 nonprofits on tier three. Tier three is severe, tier two is concerning. So we are working with the departments right now and have been for a couple of months on what is the action plan to get all of those issues resolved over the next several months. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer, but we do have success generally with getting nonprofits off of these standards. For the first time this year, we also did some reporting on the new contract monitoring policy, which is what we issued last December. So this is at the contract level, how our departments monitoring a nonprofit contract that is $200,000 or more. So this has a series of monitoring, engagement, performance reporting, and other reporting standards. So this year, since the policy just went into effect on July 1st, our assessment was of the department's policies. So we had convened some working groups to try to get all of the departments to develop their own individual policies so that I like to think of it as if they all win the lottery, or is it clear enough on what everybody has to do in the department? So this was a little more challenging for some departments who really needed to document this, and then even larger departments had the issue of how do you set a departmental policy when you may have very different programs that have to meet that policy? So we'll continue to work with departments on that implementation, and then we'll see how we're going to do the reporting in coming years. We also issued the Our Home annual report. So this was covering $331 million in spending. This is from one of the Prop C's a few years ago on business taxes. So we've got a really great web page that can show you how all of that money was spent in the last year, on which types of programs related to homelessness and mental health services. You can take a look at by the sub-programs, how much was spent, and even a little bit on the demographics. Tomorrow, we have 2 of our performance reports being issued. One is on the park standards. What does it feel like to go to a park? Scores are relatively stable, which is great news. And then we'll also be issuing our annual performance report for the entire city. So all departments will provide results on their measures that are related to their department goals, as well as some highlights of other performance. We continue to work on the capital report, as we call it, which is the biannual scope, schedule, and budget of all GO bonds. So we should have this done by March, so hopefully in April we can come and present to you. So this is another viewpoint of what you do here on a regular basis here, but from our perspective. And continuing to work on a variety of projects and continuing to work with the mayor's office on filling some vacancies. Almost 1 in 3 of my analyst positions are vacant right now, so we're trying to do some backfilling to make sure that we really can complete our work. On any questions for me before I move into public finance?
For the nonprofit audit requirements and the non-compliance, are there any common themes for why those nonprofits are non-compliant? Is it that they're just very small, that they've never had an audit requirement before, they don't have an existing auditor that works with them, or some other issues?
Those are all true, I think. The examples that you gave, this is a newer requirement that everyone has to have it. Personnel changeover also has a huge impact on this. So when there is executive turnover staff, when there is finance turnover staff, and finding that documentation, it can be challenging to get those completed. Those tend to be the reasons. It's doesn't appear to us that it's any sort of trying not to do it. It's that there are challenges in completing it.
Mm-hmm. So more procedural issues, internal process issues at the nonprofits rather than maybe a nonprofit deliberately trying to hide issues, financial issues.
Yeah. Correct, because we get the audited financial statements with the findings letter to find out what the issues are. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
I also have a question about the nonprofits. You said there were some changes, and is that just sort of compliance requirements for nonprofits, or are there? I heard the city in different ways are pushing for sort of performance metrics to be introduced. Is that still being discussed?
Yeah, so the Board of Supervisors last in March, I think, of 2024 required the Comptroller's Office to develop a new contract monitoring policy. So there was not a citywide policy that had clear expectations of what was required. And so we worked with departments, with nonprofits to develop what that policy would look like. Now we are working with departments on how to implement that and get towards that ultimate goal of how are we ensuring that departments are monitoring the performance of nonprofits and reporting on it on a regular basis and also consistently across the city.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Grant Carson, Debt Capital Market Specialist in the Comptroller's Office of Public Finance, here to speak on item 6C, future bond sales. Office of Public Finance recently priced and closed two series of geo bonds in October and November, and we've begun working with departments on the anticipated 2026 issuances. Nothing completely set in stone, but we've identified four different prior elections as candidates for potential 2026 issuances with kickoffs in either spring or summer next year. That would be the Affordable Housing 2019 election, Health and Recovery 2020 election, Earthquake Safety and Emergency Response 2020 election, and Vibrant or Healthy, Safe, and Vibrant SF 2024 election. And then happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from commissioners? No? Okay. Thank you.
Okay, for item 6D, I unfortunately do not have a final answer here for you on the bonds near completion. Still working with Public Works on this one. So the concept here is how do we designate a bond near completion that it should stop reporting at GOBOC? And what those final closeout activities are. So our test case here is the 2011 road repaving and street safety and geo bond. So I might suggest calendaring this at the February meetings to make sure that I can bring Public Works with me and we can talk about this together.
Okay.
About a proposed approach.
Okay, that sounds good. And it'd be great to get the process ironed out because it seems like there are at least two other bond programs that are nearing completion of expenditures that we'll want to add to that list so that we can relieve staff of that administrative burden when there really isn't much substance to update us on.
Great. On item 6E, so this will be committee business, I wanted to let you know you should have received a copy of your annual report for last fiscal year that we plan on publishing on December 15th. I think we have some questions about liaison roles, but maybe before that, we could take some city attorney questions that we might have. And I have a couple of them that have sort of bubbled up both in this meeting and then with a new member coming on board, is that we have questions around how many can members speak to each other outside of meetings, would be the first one, there'll be three. The second would be, can we have two liaisons assigned to a geo bond program? And then the third that came up today is if we wanted to organize a tour of some of these facilities, can we do that as a group?
So Ken Rue, Deputy City Attorney, I think I can remember all three questions, but feel free to remind me. First question, great question. Feel badly.
No. Go ahead. Look, talk to them. It's fine.
See you.
Great question. It saves us. It'll save us a lot of time in the long term. So both the Brown Act and the Sunshine Ordinance prohibit committee members from discussing committee or city business. I mean, that means committee business in this context. Outside of a properly agendized publicly noticed public meeting. The legal principle is that effectively we don't want a quorum of any policy body to get together and discuss city business. Now, we don't have any subcommittees or any small committees. I think that's correct, right, Karen? So what we're effectively talking about is a quorum of this body. But rather than even going down that path, our office's advice is just don't do it. Don't discuss city business outside of any properly agendized public meeting. If there's an issue you want to raise, present it to the controller's office. They can then put it on the agenda. That's the easiest way to handle this. One of the issues that has come up is something called a seriata meeting, where one member talks about an issue with another member. Seems like it should be fine. It's only two people, right? But then the second member talks to a third member, who then talks to a fourth member. And before we know it, we have what we call a seriata meeting, which is in violation of the Brown Act and the Sunshine Ordinance. So the practical advice we give is just don't do it. Just if you have questions or comments or concerns, bring them to the controller's office. We can agendize this. If it's like a one-off, it's like a legal advice, you can just talk to me and we can talk about it. But if it's a matter that requires deliberation or discussion with other committee members, don't do it outside of the public hearing. The third question was a tour, right?
A tour, but the second one was about, can we have two liaisons assigned to a program?
Yeah, the answer to that is no. I know that because I just discussed it with my colleagues, and I can't remember what the reasoning is behind it. It's analogous to the discussion we just had about having, if you have two or more members, you've effectively set up a policy body, which means that you then have to agendize it, have a public hearing, which defeats the entire purpose of having a liaison in the first place, right? Because you don't want to have to go through all that.
Can you elaborate on that? My recollection is, as we have had the experience of more two liaisons, yeah, to one department or liaising with staff.
That's correct.
Or updates.
Yeah. The analysis hasn't changed. Our advice has changed. So I can't remember. There is some issue that brought this to the fore.
So it's a legal issue.
Yeah, this is a legal issue. So the idea, again, now that I'm discussing it, I think it's coming back to me. The idea is that if a policy body like this committee appoints one person to be a liaison, that's not a policy body for purposes of the Brown Act or the Sunshine Ordinance. If you appoint two people, however, then you have a policy body. And a policy body has to be agendized anytime it meets. You have to have public notice.
But their role is still liaising and not inputting to the department regarding policy. It's talking to staff, explaining and understanding how operations work to supplement the reports that we're reading.
Right.
It's one of the main purposes.
It's still a discussion. You're still discussing with people. It's still city business. That's the advice of our department, that when you have two more people, you've essentially set up a policy body. And if you set up a policy body, it has to be agendized. And there has to be notice, public hearing, and so forth.
Can I ask a question on that one? So if we did have two members who wanted to talk to a department about a bond, and they decided it was okay to have that conversation that could be available to the public, does that cover more like a passive meeting body where we just have to notice that it's happening when it's happening and allow people to join and then they can do it? Or does it have to be a full hearing?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, that might be helpful because I wonder if that could be. Just you saying policy body made me think of the...
Yeah, I mean, again, I can diligence that if that's the committee's request or your request, but our office is advising just don't do it. Then if you have a policy body and those two members talk about something else, then maybe you're running afoul of a quorum requirement for another matter before the committee. So, I mean, again, the committee's direction, we can discuss this. But
if there's a legal basis for this, could you circulate something in writing to us so I can kind of read it
and yeah,
try and understand it? Whatever legal citing that you're referencing,
so
circulate it to us so at least for me.
Yeah, no, no, sure. I can send it. I think we had this discussion, so I can just forward the email I sent. But again, the principle, maybe I'm not being clear here. The principle is if you designate one person to do something, if a policy body like this committee designates a single person to do something, that single person is not a policy body for purposes of the Brown Act or Sunshine Ordinance. If you designate two or more people to act together, that is a policy body. And if you have a policy body, then all the bells and whistles that attach to the Sunshine Ordinance and Brown Act adhere. So that's the legal reasoning. I'm happy just to put that in an email.
If you follow that line of reasoning, then if more than one of the members take up on the offer of the field visit, for example.
The field trip?
The field visit, that would also create the opportunity or risk, if you will, that you alluded to.
That's right, and that is our advice. This has happened before with other committees like this, like the PUC Revenue Bond Oversight Committee. When they take tours of the PUC facilities, mm-hmm. it's agendized, and it has to be open to the public if members of the public want to come along on the tour.
So
that's
it is
exactly
doable.
Right.
So we could have more than one member join a facilities tour, but it would have to be agendized.
Correct.
And open to the public.
Yeah, there is no bar against that. It's okay. Just, do you want to go through the hassle of having to have it agendized and noticed?
Okay.
Correct.
That's helpful.
So for the purposes of us in administering the committee, we could agendize a tour, publicly notice it, have a call for individuals from the public who may want to join, and make sure that we have that included.
Yeah, we've done that many times.
Okay.
I think this committee did it maybe 15 years
ago. Okay.
I was curious how a policy body is defined.
I'm sorry?
I was curious how a policy body is defined.
I'd have to look that up.
Okay. I was just because I'm pretty sure I'm aware of several other committees where they do, you know, participate together. And then for the first question that was asked, just from an administrative capacity as far as dealing with the commission, you know, it seems like there's sort of two separate items. One is sort of asking questions, you know, performing sort of oversight functions of these bond programs. And then the second would be administrative capacities of, you know, getting a new member on board and sort of understanding the administrative capacity. And that seems separate than policy. So just as far as, you know, kind of functioning as a, you know, efficient body, it seems like being able to communicate and collaborate on non-policy aspects would be helpful, since that's how, I guess, most other ones I'm familiar with do behave.
I hear you. Unfortunately, efficiency is not a goal of the Brown Act and the Sunshine Ordinance.
Sure, and I didn't mean for this body to be more efficient. I guess I'm just aware of other commissions that do behave that way and seemed like they would operate under the same sort of statute.
Yeah, I can't comment on how other committees act. Now, just to be clear, if you have a question like, I can't think of one. I'm trying to think of one off my head. That's clearly not related to this committee's business. I mean, it's a common sense issue, right? But if you want to discuss, you know, I don't know.
A bond.
What's that?
A bond.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're concerned, like what, like that you may have uncovered waste or fraud, right, for a particular bond. I mean, you can't do it outside of a publicly noticed meeting. Now, again, you know, we can have this discussion about whether, you know, you talk to one person and then you're sure that second person isn't going to talk to anybody else on the committee about it. You're probably not in violation of the Brown Act or Sunshine Ordinance, but is that really what you want to do? You know?
So I guess I have a couple questions.
Yeah.
One is, you know, from a practical standpoint, where you have a body that has turnover, how do other commissions deal with continuity when you have only one liaison with a department and that person has to go, or their term is expired and they're no longer part of the commission, and we want to bring somebody else on board to do that role? How do other committees deal with continuity?
I don't advise a lot of other committees. There are about three other committees I advise. And generally, what they do is what this committee does. You bring someone on board, and then, you know, usually the chair will sit down with that person and say, here's what we do, along with staff. Staff can kind of bring that person up to speed on the issue. But, I understand. Mm. You know, especially as citizen volunteers, I understand your time is, you're volunteering your time and you want to make it as efficient and productive as possible. I mean, the city wouldn't function without folks like you, so it's valuable. We appreciate that. But the problem is we have these rules that just attach to how we behave as a public body, and there's, you know, from a policy perspective, maybe the controller's office can give you more advice on that. The ones I work with, you just, especially because I work on finance and bonds, it's just very detail-oriented, very complex. So you can't just, you know, say, hey, jump in and let's go. It just takes time. And sometimes there's not overlap. Sometimes some committees will go, like, you know, a while without having somebody on board, you know.
So as we continue to onboard new members, is it correct that I, as the chair, along with the staff for the committee, we can onboard somebody together on general topics related to the business of the committee?
Yeah, that's
but
right.
We wouldn't bring in one of the other committee members who is a liaison on that particular program to give a debrief of what they've been doing.
Again, I wouldn't advise it.
Okay.
But I mean, to go to the letter of the law, if we have no other subcommittees and there are two of you and you speak to a third person and none of the three of you speaks to anyone else about any of that committee business, so it's three people, that's less than a quorum, technically you're not violating the Brown Act or Sunshine Ordinance. We don't advise that because it seems like it's a hassle, like you walk out and then, like, you know, say you and Brenda are together and you're bringing on Benjamin, and then you walk out and you're like, oh, Benjamin raised a good point about this issue I want to talk to Brian about, right? Then you're at four. You know, so that's the advice.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's helpful to understand the contours.
What's that?
It's helpful to understand the contours of what we're permitted.
And I'm always
not
available.
To.
So, you know, if you're like, hey, can we talk about this? Is this an issue? You can just call me or email me, and I can tell you quickly, don't worry about that. That's not an issue. I would avoid talking about this, or you can talk about that, but don't talk about it this way, you know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And I realize it sounds abstract and esoteric, but I can assure you, you know, I've been in the city attorney's office almost 21 years now. I can assure you there have been multiple occasions when citizens have become upset about what they perceive to be deliberations made outside of issues that are of public concern and things that they felt that if they had known about, people were discussing it, they wanted to be involved in it. So I'm just throwing that out there as well.
Understood.
You know. And I think I forgot. Did I forget one question? I feel like I forgot.
Oh, it was about the tour.
The tours. Which you,
about a tour.
Yeah, the tour. As I said, we've done that many times before. That's not a problem. We it's a little bit of a hassle, so we'll have to work on it. But we just have to open up to the public. I have never had a member of the public show up for one of these tours once. It's not a guarantee. You know, past results are not guarantees of future whatever. But I've never had a member of the public show up once. You just agendize it, and then you just go on the tour, and it's not a problem.
Yeah.
So I would certainly advise you to take the tour. We can just work with staff to make it work.
Yeah, that's helpful because I think that, especially with a number of newer members to the committee, and that we don't want to overburden staff with separate individual tours, that if there is a mechanism for us to do that, in this case, just agendize it, and then we can bring as many members that are that are interested, I think that's a great solution. So thank you.
Yeah, as I say, the PUC Revenue Bond Oversight Committee, they used to take tours of the PUC assets, especially the generating assets, you know. And when I was advising that body, I think they did it maybe 5 or 6 times. And, you know, they had to, like, reserve extra seats on the tour bus in case members of the public showed up. And it was never an issue. It was never. So, yeah, I think it's useful for this committee's work to actually see the stuff you're working on. So I would advise that.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee?
Okay. Oh, I have it's just really a comment that term policy body. I just find it interesting because we're not a policy making committee. We're an oversight committee.
True, but you have the power to enjoin future bond issuances. So you do have a policy arm if you choose to exercise it.
Huh.
Like one provision of the statute.
Yeah.
And it's very narrow. But it makes us a policy body.
But
and it's very
hand,
powerful, by the way. I wouldn't discount it. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. I mean, I see both sides because we're also, our role is to be a member of the public, right? And to raise concerns that we think members of the public might have. So I just think our committee is very interesting because, you know, we don't set policy at the same time. You know, excuse me, becoming these policy bodies is sort of, against our role.
Yeah.
As members of the public, so.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Any other questions or comments?
Oh, sir.
Okay.
So I will say we are happy to work with you on figuring out how to do bonds and noticing and that sort of thing.
That would be great.
So I think we wanted a discussion about liaison assignments or not.
Well, my understanding is that the mayor's office is working on one more appointment.
Okay.
And so perhaps we can discuss liaison roles after that appointment's been made.
Okay, great. And then just as a note, the liaison assignments are on the calendar, the work plan calendar that we do post with every meeting, and you have a copy in front of you. Just so we all remember sometimes. Some of us forget where it is. and then actually, I wanted to say one more.
Can I
jump go ahead.
In real quick? So I didn't want to do this while we were speaking because it seemed rude. But I just looked up the definition of policy body, which I think somebody had asked. So the Brown, this, I may read, it's like a paragraph, but this might be useful. The Brown Act applies to legislative bodies. Generally, the Act defines a legislative body as any local government board, commission, committee, or other body, whether permanent or temporary, decision-making or advisory created by charter, ordinance, resolution, or formal action of a legislative body. The governing body of a local agency or local body, well, we don't need to worry about that. The Sunshine Ordinance applies to policy bodies. Its definition of policy body is similar to but broader than the Brown Act definition of legislative body. In our discussion of open meeting laws, and by the way, this is our good government guide, which is on our website, and I bring this to all my meetings. If you're ever interested, this is a great resource, and it's written by our government team. These are the people whom I consult with, so they're the ones who tell me this stuff. So I would recommend you just review this. Where are we? Oh, so policy body encompasses all of these entities that are in the Sunshine Ordinance and all legislative bodies under the Brown Act. If I'm going on too long, let me know. I'll just read one more thing. Policy bodies include the city's board and commissions, any advisory body created by the charter or the board of supervisors, or by the initiative of a board, commission, or other policy body, any committee of a policy body, and any advisory board, commission, committee, or council created by federal, state, or local grant, blah, 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 blah. And that's admin code 67.3D. Bodies created by the mayor or department head are not, well, we don't need to get into that. So anyway, I don't know if that's responsive. I can't remember who asked the question.
It doesn't say oversight, however.
What's that?
There's no, the word oversight is not in there. It's advisory or policy making, right? Yeah. We are a policy board. Okay.
That, I mean, seriously, that is, I've realized it's never been used, but that's not a trivial power this committee has. I mean, if you forget about even exercising it, if you choose to go down that path, that's going to be a huge issue. So that's something to be taken seriously. I'm serious. You know.
Okay.
So I have one last item, and I hate to keep you in the lovely world that I love about arcane administrative code charter requirements, but I did want to give you an update on the Commission Streamlining Task Force that was Prop E of last November. So as it currently stands, the committee, or task force, of which I am a member, representing the controller's office, has completed the bulk of the decision making. We should have a draft report out next week. That report has to be finalized by January 31st or February 1st, I can't remember. As it relates to GOBOC in some of the standardization that we're trying to do to make government more easy to understand and consistent is on term lengths of members. And so changes that could possibly happen to GOBOC is that we would increase term limits from 2 to 3 years with a 4-term limit. This is something we're trying to standardize across city bodies. And then for seat qualifications, in order to help, the task force idea here is in order to help with recruitment and filling of positions, is to make the qualifications that are currently tied to a particular seat in a particular appointing body to be desirable at the body level, so that hopefully appointing bodies could find more members more quickly to sort of make sure that there aren't quorum issues.
Can I ask a question about that? So does that mean that the qualifications would not be required, they would be desired?
I believe so. This is actually one we're now going to be working on at a global level, on how does it, because the city attorney's in the process of drafting and has a lot of questions about that in particular. But hopefully for you, 2 years comes up very quickly to do renominations and reappointments should you desire, or you're filling out a shorter term. Hopefully that 3 years will also help with some of the administrative burden on all of you.
I have not done my due diligence reading the minutes from the last couple of task force meetings, but is there still talk of combining this body with the MTA Revenue Board?
There is not.
Citizens Advisory.
Yeah, that was decided not to happen. Any other business items for the committee? Okay.
I don't think so. Okay. Then thank you. Can we please take public comment?
Members of the public who wish to provide in-person public comment, please line up at the podium now. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak. For the record, there are no in-person public comments. This concludes the public comment section for this agenda item.
Please call the next item.
Item number 7, opportunity for the for committee members to comment on any matters within the committee's jurisdiction.
Commissioners, any other items for discussion?
Nope.
We need to take public comment on this? Okay, can we please take public comment?
Members of the public who wish to provide in-person public comment on this agenda item, please line up at the podium now. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak. For the record, there are no in-person public comments. This concludes the public comment section for this agenda item.
Okay, thank you. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.